He was a small man from a small town in Missouri. He spent the first six decades of his life toiling in relative obscurity. But when the time came, he made one of the most difficult decisions anyone's ever had to make. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you're going to meet the man my father said saved his life. My dad was a World War II U.S. Army infantry officer. He served in Patton's Third Army. He was a hero, received a Silver Star fighting Hitler's legions in France and Germany. But when the war in Europe ended on 8 May 1945, my father's unit, the 95th Infantry Division, was tagged ahead for the Pacific for the invasion of Japan. This podcast isn't about my dad. It's about Harry S. Truman. And by the end of this podcast, you'll know why my Republican father described Democrat President Truman as a lifesaver. You'll also hear about Truman's love of country, his own service in World War I, and even his love of poker. Harry Truman became our nation's 33rd president on 12 April 1945, on the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Afterwards, he said with absolute candor, "It's as though the sun, the moon, and the stars have fallen on me." It may be hard to believe, but as FDR's VP, Truman was never informed about a secret weapon being developed to end the world's bloodiest war. I had the opportunity to interview three surviving members of the Truman administration, George Elsie, Ken Heckler, and Milton Kahle. You'll hear them describe Truman the politician and Truman the courageous leader. Listen carefully to Harry Truman's eldest grandson, Clifton Truman Daniel, and his views on the enormous challenges his grandfather faced on whether to use the atomic bomb, how to counter Soviet expansion, and rebuild old enemies into new allies. In today's polarized politics, this podcast about Give 'em Hell, Harry, may even offer a fresh perspective on how an unexpected president contended with economic challenges, contentious rivals, a bloody new war, and a divisive hunt for enemies inside our own government. And when it's over, let me know if this podcast answers the question my brothers and sister wondered about. Why did our dad and so many others with whom he served in World War II say, "Harry Truman saved my life"?
This is the gravesite of a remarkable American leader. A president who had to make some of the most momentous decisions in our nation's history. I'm Oliver North. This is War Stories, coming to you from the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum in Independence, Missouri. It seems hard to believe today, but as Vice President, Harry Truman was never informed about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's plans for ending the carnage of World War II, or the powerful secret weapon being developed to hasten our victory. All that changed on 12 April 1945 with FDR's sudden death. After just 82 days as vice president, Harry Truman took the oath of office as the nation's 33rd president of the United States. Yet, as you'll see in this episode, the tenacious Harry Truman rose to the occasion and the enormous challenges he'd face in the months and years ahead. Whether to use the atomic bomb, how to counter Soviet expansion, and rebuild Europe and Japan, and then a new war in Korea. All this came on his watch. Join us as we examine the fascinating life and trying times of Harry S. Truman.
By January 1945, the Allied noose was tightening around Hitler's failing war machine as battles raged in the Pacific. And in Washington, Harry Truman became vice president to a man elected for an unprecedented fourth term, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Truman meets with Roosevelt at the White House.
Alonzo Hanby is a distinguished professor of history at Ohio University. 10 years of research went into his book, Man of the People.
Truman tells the press when they ask, "Does the president look in good health?" "Oh, he's in great shape, wonderful." Then he writes to Bess, "I'm really worried. His hands were shaking so much he could hardly hold a cup of coffee." He's very apprehensive about Roosevelt being able to survive.
Truman was worried, but the American people knew nothing about FDR's declining health. His death in April 1945 from a cerebral hemorrhage stunned the nation. It also left many people wondering, could a bespectacled Missouri farm boy named Harry S. Truman lead America in war?
Was he ready?
Short answer is no.
No president in American history has ever been faced with the tremendous foreign problems that confront Harry Truman.
Harry Truman needs to be understood basically as someone who's a member of the Midwestern aspiring middle class. Came out of a culture in which people were either farmers or businessmen.
Harry S. Truman was born to John and Martha Ellen Truman in Lamar, Missouri, 120 miles from Kansas City, on 8 May, 1884.
His father was a farmer who had branched out, had some business interests in town.
Clifton Truman Daniel is Harry Truman's eldest grandson.
What was his relationship like with his own mom and dad?
He was very close to his parents and his brother Vivian and his sister Martha Jane. From his dad, he got his pugnacious attitude. His father loved to talk politics. And from his mother, he got his love of books, of studying, of music.
His mother also decided that the family needed to be near better schools. In 1890, they left the farm and moved to Independence, Missouri, 10 miles from Kansas City. It was there that six-year-old Harry discovered a love that would last a lifetime.
When did he meet your grandmother?
Met my grandmother when they were in Sunday school. He was six and she was five. That was the first time they laid eyes on each other.
Bess Wallace was from one of the most prominent families in Independence.
What did her folks do?
Her father, David Wallace, was a politician. Her mother was a town socialite.
Harry maintained that the first time he saw her, he thought she was the most beautiful person he'd ever seen.
Michael Devine is the director of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Museum and Library, home to more than 7 million pages of Truman's personal papers.
And as far as we can tell, he never dated any other women in high school or beyond.
When he was 6 years old, my great-grandparents took him to a 4th of July celebration in Independence. And that evening when the fireworks were going off over here, Grandpa was looking over here somewhere. And his mother took him to the eye doctor the next day.
How bad were his eyes?
He had a very serious case of myopia, extreme nearsightedness. They required very thick corrective lenses.
At his mother's urging, young Harry studied hard and became a voracious reader of history. He also began to play the piano, dreaming of a career as a concert pianist. But when Truman left high school in 1901, his poor eyesight became an even greater hindrance.
He had these dreams as a kid of going to West Point, becoming a professional military officer. That never got very far. He even went down to a recruiting station in Kansas City. One shot at the eye chart and the recruiting officer told him to get lost.
He did not have an opportunity to go to college. His family didn't have the money.
Harry's father, John, had started speculating in grain futures, and the results were disastrous. Forced to sell their farm, they relocated to Kansas City. Harry eventually found a job at a bank paying $35 a month. He also joined the National Guard.
He joins on his 21st birthday in 1905.
He memorized the eye chart so that he could read it off without hesitation when it came time for the exam.
Harry enjoyed the camaraderie of the Guard and the bustle of Kansas City. But when his parents moved to work a family-owned farm in Grandview, Missouri, Harry was summoned to help.
So my grandfather left the bank, left the city, and went back out to the farm. He was out there almost 12 years, and during that time, he reacquainted himself with my grandmother.
Courting Bess made years of hard work on the farm more bearable, but Harry wanted more out of life, and his father's death in 1914 meant it was time for him to strike out on his own.
Starts out with a couple of other investors in 1916, getting into a lead and zinc mine in northern Oklahoma. That lasts about 6 months, turns out to be a washout. He gets involved then with a rather speculative oil operation.
They apparently drilled until they ran out of money and then sold the well, and the guy who bought it drilled a little further and hit oil.
Harry Truman was, however, not a very good businessman. We might say that he made a habit of buying high and selling low. World War I starts in 1917. He knows that all National Guard units are going to be federalized, and he wants to be a part of it.
And he had to pass an eye exam to go overseas. He passed the eye exam the only way he could. He cheated. He had to memorize the eye chart. He was so anxious to go with this unit.
Truman took command of an artillery battery and deployed to France to fight the Germans.
Here's a person who sees frontline wars, who sees rows of bodies along the road as he and his outfit move up toward the front.
How was he changed by his World War I experience in France?
That was when he learned he could lead men. He had to take a group of very rough guys and whip them into shape. He found that he had the ability to bring men together and lead them forward as a cohesive unit.
In many ways, it was the defining experience of his life.
When battle-hardened Harry Truman returned home to Missouri, he and Bess were finally married.
When Harry married Bess in 1919, they came here to this house in Independence, Missouri, to live with Bess's mother.
And yet Harry never quite met Mrs. Wallace's expectations.
No, Mrs. Wallace was upset that her daughter had married a farmer, that Bess could have married a banker or someone more prominent in the community.
Poor Grandpa, he never ever said a word against her, never raised his voice, never argued with her.
Harry tried again at business with a friend he'd met in the National Guard, Eddie Jacobson.
They decide to open this haberdashery store in downtown Kansas City. Harry borrows money to get it started, and Jacobson will provide the merchandising expertise.
Grandpa was the front man. He was the people guy. He was out there shaking hands and selling. Unfortunately, the recession early in 1922 killed him, so they lost the haberdashery.
After he has lost every dollar he can raise to go into business, it's at this point that he goes into politics.
A notorious Kansas City political boss helps Harry Truman make it to the big leagues. That's next on War Stories.
September 1922. A victim of the post-World War I recession, the Truman and Jacobson Haberdashery closed its doors for good. Harry Truman would spend the next 15 years paying off his debts. At the age of 38, with yet another failed business on his resume, Truman was desperate for a job. It was then that he met the king of Kansas City politics.
Tom Pendergast, the boss of the Kansas City Democratic machine. One of his friends, Jim Pendergast, took Grandpa over to meet Tom, and next thing he knew, he was running for judge.
They call it a county judge, but it was really a county commissioner. The Pendergast machine was looking for someone who was well known in rural Jackson County. And Jim Pendergast says, well, the guy you want is Harry Truman.
Truman fights and wins. His political career has started.
At just 5'9", Tom Pendergast was a powerful politician. The fiery, cigar-smoking son of Irish immigrants had controlled Kansas City politics since 1911.
Pendergast was the engine behind the Democratic machine in the 1920s and 30s.
Many large cities were run by bosses who raked off a large portion of the take. Under Tom Pendergast, everyone knew there was a lot of graft.
But Harry frequently went against the grain.
Grandpa always maintained his position as a straightforward politician within that machine. He tried on several occasions to have Grandpa at one point throw road building, paving contracts to Pendergast cronies.
Truman insisted that there be public bids, that other firms get a chance to bid on the project because Tom Pendergast owned a concrete company.
But Grandpa said their work was not up to par, so he wouldn't do it. He wanted the roads built well. So he stuck to his guns, and Pendergast respected him for that and let him do what he wanted.
Things were looking up for Harry, and he had another reason to be proud. In 1924, Bess gave birth to Margaret, their only child. The stock market crash of 1929 brought the Roaring Twenties to a close. Truman saw firsthand the effects of the Great Depression.
The Depression hit Missouri pretty hard, particularly the rural areas.
Backed by Tom Pendergast, Truman decided to run for the U.S. Senate in the election of 1934.
Truman, having this farm, rural background, was able to connect with the rural voters throughout Missouri.
Is he campaigning as a New Deal Democrat?
Oh, yeah.
When first elected president in 1932, FDR had promised the American people a New Deal, including bank reform laws and work relief programs.
He supported the Roosevelt programs pretty much down the line, not just out of party loyalty, out of personal belief.
Truman won the 34 election by 20 percentage points.
Did any of the Pendergast connections taint his run?
His opponents called him the gentleman from Pendergast. It's something that follows him to Washington. There are a lot of his colleagues who are looking down on him because he's connected to this machine. It sort of reinforces a feeling that I think Truman has for much of his life, a feeling that he doesn't get the respect he deserves.
Someone told him, you will spend the first 6 months of your time in the Senate wondering how in the hell you got there. And after that, you will spend your time wondering how in the hell everybody else got there.
Bess moves to Washington with him, but they assume that they're only going to be there 6 months of the year. Due to the Depression, they wind up being separated quite a bit.
Dear Bess, I am awful tired and awful lonesome. If you feel like giving me hell, do it. Kiss Margaret for me and keep on writing. Lots of love, Harry.
With his family 1,000 miles away, the lonely senator began to learn Washington's ways.
He loved the give and take, the back room, deal making, the card games, the glass of bourbon after hours. He loved all of that.
But when he ran for re-election in 1940, Truman no longer had Tom Pendergast to grease the wheels. His political patron was serving time for tax evasion. Undaunted, Truman campaigned hard and narrowly won re-election by 2.5%. Though America was not yet in the war, defense production had soared dramatically, and Truman began to make a name for himself as a watchdog in Washington.
He chairs a committee that investigates essentially war production.
What became known as the Truman Committee.
Looks for waste, fraud, and abuse.
Harry would later claim his committee saved the taxpayers $15 billion. A questionable amount. But one thing was certain. Truman was becoming a force to be reckoned with.
And by 1944 seems a real possibility for vice president.
Harry Truman overcomes the senator from Pendergast tag to become FDR's running mate. That's next on War Stories.
July 21, 1944. U.S. Marines and soldiers storm ashore on Guam and the Mariana Islands in the Pacific. In Chicago at the Democratic National Convention, a reluctant Harry Truman put on a brave front as he accepted nomination as FDR's vice president.
I appreciate this very great honor which has come to the great state of Missouri, a very great responsibility which I am perfectly willing to assume.
He tried to do everything to avoid it.
He wants to stay in the Senate. He's been a great success there. He has the esteem of most of his colleagues.
It's not his prominence as a senator that puts him on the 1944 ticket. It's the fact that the Democratic Party leaders don't want Henry Wallace on the ticket.
Henry Wallace served as vice president during FDR's third term.
Wallace is very unpopular with the party leaders. They're looking for someone to replace him.
Truman seemed to have no great enemies anywhere in the party, and thus he became the Missouri Compromise. Throughout the selection process and throughout his vice presidency, Truman was largely ignored by Roosevelt.
But that didn't make Truman unique. FDR always played his cards close to the vest. But there was one thing that Truman couldn't ignore about FDR, his failing health.
Truman goes through this campaign knowing that he's going to be vice president to a president who seems to be in a very shaky condition.
On 7 November 1944, the Roosevelt-Truman ticket beat Republicans Tom Dewey and John Bricker in the presidential election.
At the inaugural, are the two together for any length of time?
No, not at the inaugural. Roosevelt speaks for only a few minutes, and it appears to have been timed by his doctors. This is just how sick he was. Truman's aware of that.
We were very conscious that he was physically was slowing down.
George Elzey was a 24-year-old naval reservist from Oakmont, Pennsylvania, when he was assigned to work in the White House map room.
It's apparent that he's not in the best of health. And could you see that?
March 29th, 45, he came into the library where my office then was. I was stunned at his appearance. I stood up, of course, when he came in and said, "Good afternoon, Mr. President." Got no response at all from him. That was the last time he was alive in the White House.
Truman sees Roosevelt just before Roosevelt goes off to Warm Springs, Georgia for the last time, telling him, "Well, Harry, I need a couple of weeks to rest up there. I'm going to be in great shape again."
2 weeks later, 63-year-old Franklin Roosevelt died from a cerebral hemorrhage.
How does Truman find out that FDR has died?
Truman was in the Capitol about 5 o'clock in the afternoon when he got the message to go to the White House immediately. When Truman arrives at the White House, he's met at the door by Eleanor Roosevelt, who tells him, "Harry, the president's dead." And Truman is just absolutely shocked.
He often said that at that time he felt that the sun and the moon and all the stars had fallen on him.
The funeral service was there in the East Room of the White House. When Mrs. Roosevelt entered the room, everyone stood, silence, of course. When an aide announced the president and Mrs. Truman, nobody stood. We were still in awe of Roosevelt. In retrospect, of course, it was a horrible breach of protocol, etiquette, and everything else.
When he went to Mrs. Roosevelt and asked her, "Is there anything we can do for you?" She said, "Mr. President, I think the question is there anything we can do for you? You're the one who's in trouble now."
Harry Truman called his first year as president a year of decisions. His most momentous decision? To end World War II and usher in the atomic age. That's next on War Stories.
I ask only to be a good and faithful servant of my Lord and my people.
12 April 1945. As the war in Europe drew to a close, Harry S. Truman was sworn in as President of the United States. On the same day, FDR died.
Roosevelt made no effort to inform his vice president of war strategy, Manhattan Project, or anything else.
After Truman's first cabinet meeting as president, Secretary of War Henry Stimson let him in on a big secret.
He arranged a full briefing for Truman on the whole Manhattan Project.
Is he aware of the awesome power of this weapon?
I think he's aware of the potential power of the atomic bomb. He knows that this is bigger than anything.
With 600,000 Americans working in some capacity on the atomic bomb, Germany surrendered. It was 8 May 1945, Harry Truman's 61st birthday.
He often said that was a great 61st birthday present to get.
This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day.
Later that month, George Elzey accompanied Bess Truman on the shy First Lady's first official appearance, christening two planes with champagne at Washington's National Airport.
Mrs. Truman swung, nothing happened. Mrs. Truman swung again, nothing happened. Mrs. Truman swung 11 times and nothing happened. By this time, the crowd in the bleachers was laughing uproariously at this, and Mrs. Truman's face showed her rage.
A crew member saved the day when, unseen by the crowd, he smashed the seemingly indestructible champagne bottle with a hammer.
And the crowd roared with applause. Mrs. Truman, on the way back to the White House, said, "Never, never, never again will I be in that situation."
July 1945. As the fighting and dying continued in the Pacific, George Elzey traveled with President Truman aboard the USS Augusta to the Potsdam Conference in Germany.
President Truman at the conference, where an American-British-Chinese ultimatum to Japan was issued.
Truman, Churchill, and Stalin were meeting to discuss post-war Europe and finishing off the Japanese.
His major goal, I think, was to establish himself as a figure on the same level as those two.
Truman was very optimistic. He thought he'd gotten along well with Stalin. There was no sense yet that things were going to be rough with Stalin.
At Potsdam, Truman informed Churchill that the test of an atomic bomb in the New Mexico desert had gone as planned.
Truman and Churchill now had to think of, do we tell Stalin anything? The answer was no, we won't tell him anything other than we have a powerful new weapon.
American planners projected as many as 1 million casualties if the Allies had to invade Japan. On 25 July, Harry Truman gave Henry Stimson the final go-ahead to unleash the new weapon on the Japanese.
Turns out the first bomb is dropped before you get back.
At that point, no one knew just which day it was going to be because the actual decision day was being left in the hands of the Air Force, depending on weather conditions over Japan.
As Truman sailed from Potsdam, Secretary Stimson sent a message to the USS Augusta in the Atlantic. On 6 August, the atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima, Japan.
I took the Stimson message to the president.
Any reaction?
I wouldn't say joy, but great relief.
But the Japanese still refused to surrender. A second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki on 9 August. An estimated 200,000 people died as a result of the bombings.
How difficult was it for your grandfather to decide to use the atomic bomb?
He was horrified in the aftermath of the explosion at the effects of the bomb. The decision to use it, however, was for him very simple. It was a matter of saving American lives.
On 14 August 1945, Harry Truman announced that World War II was finally over.
I get the sense he did not spend a lot of time anguishing over decisions that had to be made.
No, he felt he'd made the best one he could make. He went on to the next one.
The war may have been over, but Truman's problems were just beginning.
There were high prices and shortages of all sorts of things, and people complained mightily about it.
There's a lot of labor chaos. You have unions that had been working under contracts that went back to before the war.
Plagued by mounting inflation, the country was also hit with massive strikes in the steel, coal, and oil industries. When railroad workers walked off the job in the spring of 1946, an angry Harry Truman threatened to draft them into the military.
At many coal fields, the scenes were ominous.
America's economy was in trouble, and the public blamed Harry Truman. His approval rating dropped from 87% in 1945 to just 32% in the fall of 46. But Harry Truman found one bright spot in the doom and gloom.
He became an expert in foreign policy.
Roslyn, New York native Ken Heckler was a special assistant to Harry Truman from 1949 to 1953.
Even though he had no experience in the area of foreign affairs, he had certain basic instincts which proved to be highly successful.
How concerned is he about the advance of Soviet communism?
There. Refusal to evacuate their troops out of Eastern Europe bothered him more and more and more.
The optimism that Truman felt about Stalin after their meeting at Potsdam quickly faded.
Stalin had refused to honor the agreements which he had made. He began to realize that Stalin's intentions were to try to spread the gospel of communism into other Western European countries.
February 1947, the British government informs the U.S. State Department it can no longer provide financial aid to Greece and Turkey.
These were two countries who were trying to resist the efforts of Stalin to try to make those countries communist countries.
And if they collapse, who knows what will happen? One country after another in Eastern Europe will be totally dominated by the Soviets.
A month later, Truman asked Congress for $400 million in military and economic assistance to Greece and Turkey. As the Cold War began, America's isolationism ended forever.
The Truman Doctrine came into being. Aid to Greece and Turkey, followed by the European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan. a program that is checking the Red Advance on many fronts.
The State Department realized that massive infusions of American aid would be required to bring about a rapid development of Europe.
The Marshall Plan was intended to avoid the mistakes made after World War I.
In the complete humiliation of Germany and the rampant inflation and poverty and all of that that gave rise to Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. So he wasn't going to do that again.
It enabled us to rebuild those countries which remained our allies in terms of trying to oppose the incursions of Stalin.
In June of 1948, the Soviets tried to drive the Allies out of Berlin by blockading the German capital. Without road and rail deliveries of essential goods, the city began to starve.
But President Truman said, "I don't want to cause World War III. We will send an airlift into Berlin." And this was a tremendous success because it forced the Russians to back down.
But containing communism wasn't the only issue for Harry Truman in 1948. He was also becoming a champion of civil rights. In July, he issued Executive Order 9981, ending segregation in the U.S. military.
All the signs are Truman on the first ballot.
When Strom Thurmond and walked out of the 1948 Democratic National Convention in protest against President Truman's civil rights program, a reporter asked Thurmond, "Why are you doing this?" Because President Truman is just doing what President Roosevelt stood for, and Thurmond said, "There's a difference. Truman really means it."
When War Stories returns, George Elsie recalls life on the grueling cross-country whistle-stop tour of 1948. Stay tuned. September 1948. The Democratic Party's nominee was Harry Truman. But economic woes and voter anxiety made victory a long shot.
I accept the nomination.
7 weeks before the election, Truman was a 13-point underdog to Republican challenger Tom Dewey.
"I know that we're going to win this crusade for the right."
Despite the bleak outlook, the man of the people refused to quit and boarded a train to hit the campaign trail. And George Elsie was along for the ride.
Truman barnstormed the country, as many as 15 whistle-stop speeches per day, usually in Truman's very blunt, forthright language. He's free entertainment, and they love to hear him.
"This Republican Congress has already stuck a pitchfork in the farmer's back."
For a total of 33 days, Truman's whistle-stop campaign covered over 13,000 miles and 27 states.
When somebody would give the chant, "Give him hell, Harry," Truman would simply say, "I don't give them hell. I just tell them the truth, and they think it's hell."
A week before the election, Truman trailed Dewey by just 5 points.
We were in Minnesota, and he said, "George, take your pencil and start writing." And he began rattling off each state, telling me in which column to put the Electoral College votes. At the end, he said, "How many do I have?" And I totaled up and said, "340, Mr. President." Well, he only needed 256. He was so confident that he had it in the bag.
On the night of the election, with votes still uncounted, the Chicago Daily Tribune jumped the gun and created a photo op for the ages.
And Dewey defeats Truman, one of the most famous photographs that has ever been taken.
He held it up just as a gag before reporters.
In reality, Truman pulled off a stunning come-from-behind victory.
"I accept with humility the honor which the American people have conferred upon me."
But the celebration was short-lived.
Things began to get rough very early in the second term.
On the 25th of June, 1950, President Truman got a phone call from Secretary of State Dean Acheson with the shocking news that the North Koreans had crossed the 38th parallel.
Aided by the Soviet Union and China, 135,000 North Korean troops invaded South Korea. President Truman immediately sought help from the United Nations.
"Free nations must be on their guard more than ever before against this kind of sneak attack."
He would never have taken an action without support of are allies.
Utica, New York native Milton Kahle was a special assistant in the Truman administration from 1951 to 53.
He immediately put the machinery in mind to get the support of the United Nations.
With World War II hero General Douglas MacArthur in command of UN forces, Harry Truman was once again a wartime president.
Things went steadily downhill thereafter.
You had to worry about inflation, the economy getting out of hand. After going through all that with World War II, it explains why Harry Truman's popularity was below 30%.
George Elsie, Milton Kahle, and Ken Heckler would accompany the president to Key West, Florida, at what came to be called the Little White House, where they often sported colorful attire.
Truman was wearing an outrageous shirt, and he was asking everybody else to copy it, and he would even have a contest to see which one was voted the most outrageous.
Every morning he'd get up, meet the president after our breakfast, walk down to the Truman Beach.
Swimming, boating, back for a card game, dinner, and then more poker. Truman loved these poker games. When it was just us staff members, there was always a $100 limit on the pot. When big shots of one sort or another, there was no limit.
He was far more relaxed when he was here.
But back in the Capitol, there were plenty of headaches.
This, my good friends, is an American issue.
One in particular was Senator Joseph McCarthy.
President Truman was appalled at Senator McCarthy's unprincipled charges.
The idea that the government was rife with communist leading people was ridiculous.
He, of course, thought McCarthy was despicable. There was no love lost between those two men.
Harry Truman fires a living legend and creates a political firestorm.
MacArthur had disobeyed written instructions. He knew, as we did, that all hell would break loose.
That's next on War Stories.
September 1950. Douglas MacArthur turns the tide in Korea by breaking the enemy's back at Incheon and Seoul. He then prepared to trek north toward the North Korea-China border.
MacArthur wanted to expand the war in a way that Truman felt would be disastrous.
Truman feared intervention by the Soviets and the communist Chinese. 15 October. The president lands on Wake Island for a progress report, face-to-face.
MacArthur assures him the Korean War is about over.
I've come back with increased confidence in our long-range ability to maintain world peace.
A month later, the Chinese are in Korea in force.
When the Chinese communists came in, this he took very, very personally, the terrible loss of life.
MacArthur had predicted that he would have troops coming home by Christmas of 1950. Actually, he was in full retreat.
MacArthur, in one insubordinate way after another, suggests it's all Harry Truman's fault.
11 April 1951, Truman fires MacArthur.
General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
The fallout reverberated around the nation. Truman's approval rating would plummet to an historic low of 22%. Then, after losing the New Hampshire primary, Truman made this announcement.
I shall not be a candidate for re-election. I have served my country long, and I think efficiently and honestly.
Maybe what really makes the difference is Bess, who tells him, I don't think you could survive another term as president, and I know I couldn't survive another term as first lady.
And the final months in office offered Truman no relief. Korea turned into a bloody stalemate, and domestic strife tarnished his record. November 1952, former World War II Allied commander and Republican candidate Dwight Eisenhower wins the presidential election in a landslide. The Truman family was soon heading home.
Yeah, I appreciate it more than I can tell you. Again, thank you with all my heart.
What did he say to you on your way out the door?
I told him that regardless of what I would do in the future, it wouldn't equal what I experienced I had with him. And then he leaned forward and grabbed my hand. said, Cale, I wish I were your age.
In Independence, Truman began writing his memoirs and developing his museum and library.
He walked with a very brisk walk. He picked them up and laid them down, as we used to say.
Ron Stewart's a retired police officer who helped protect the former president for 12 years.
I always admired the way he handled school children. And he would stand up for long periods of time and answer questions and react with the children and tell them stories about history.
Harry was also a good Samaritan. When a man's car broke down outside his home, the former president sat with him as they waited for help.
When it was time to go, the man stood up and shook Grandpa's hands. Grandpa said, anytime, nice to talk to you. The man walked out the front door, got halfway down the front steps, and turned around and looked up and said, you know something? You look like that son of a bitch, Harry Truman. And Grandpa just smiled at him and said, I am that son of a bitch.
More on the life and times of Harry S. Truman when War Stories continues. On 26 December 1972, Harry Truman died at 88.
People don't talk right off the bat about the Marshall Plan, about the Truman Doctrine, about the use of atomic weapons. What they talk about is the man, a straightforward human being who did the best he could in the job and didn't lie to them.
A straight shooter.
A straight shooter.
Truman always thought of himself as an ordinary person. He had given the country 100%.
He was able to understand the true principles of the United States of America and what it stands for.
Anthony Eden, the foreign minister of Britain, was in Washington and had a meeting with Truman. He quotes Truman in his memoirs as saying, Eden, I was put in this office to make decisions, and I am going to make them. In the end, that's probably his greatest strength.
He loved his hometown, he loved his people, and he loved his country. That was Harry Truman.
When Harry Truman left office in 1953, fewer than a third of Americans approved of the job he had done as president. Yet when he was buried here in December of 1972, he was remembered around the world as a man of character and integrity, and is today regarded as one of America's greatest presidents. Harry Truman made the toughest calls and pressed on, despite the effect on his political fortunes. He was, according to one newspaper, direct, fallible, and unexpectedly wise when it counted. His is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.